Pickaxe.
Triforce Podcast.
You do that intro, but that's not the way you normally talk. I want people to know that.
Yeah.
Like when we see you, when we haven't seen you in a while, you don't go, "Hello, I am Lewis Brindley.
No,
hello,
it's
nice
course.
To see you."
When we get on the Discord, he's like, "Oh, hey.
Hey, just got to make a cup of tea. Back in a minute."
Hey, guys.
Well, look, it's just a little thing. I don't know. It gets me in the mood. You know, you've got to psych yourself up for this.
You do.
Yeah. Gotta put your game face on, put your game hat on.
Do you do like when you're talking and stuff? Do you do lots of arm and hand gestures
like an Italian?
No,
you should. Pinch your thumb and forefinger together and wave your hands in front of your face when you really want to appeal to someone. Why?
Yeah.
Molto bene.
It's a pizza.
I love that. When you go to Italy, they really do that. They really do that. They do.
It's part of the language to speak with. They really do that.
Yeah.
It's part of the vigor of that passion. You know, you have to do
passion,
it
yeah.
as well, or else they don't get the message across. Honestly, words are not enough. If you could supplement them with hand gestures and like pictures,
yeah,
and you know, graphs, great. I'm down. I think we should all be more willing to do presentations.
I think that's what that Mr. Big song was about. More than words. The song "More Than Words" was talking about.
More than
that.
Words is all you have to say to make me feel like
this way.
This way.
Then more you than wouldn't have to say
that.
There's a lot of says in there.
Me,
holy crap!
Because I'd already. No.
Say. I mean, no. they just rhyme say. It's lazy. You can't rhyme say with say three times.
Lazy.
Like, there's. You could say way, blue jay. I
wonder how many times, like, people have got the wrong idea from words and it's led to, like, bad stuff to happen, you know? Because it's never clear. Like, I watched 1917 yesterday, which is...
Oh, yeah. was it good?
I thought it was... great.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of people
really
have said
good.
That. A lot
1917.
Of people.
Yeah.
I really want to see it. I do really want to see it.
I mean, you've heard that it's shot in one shot.
Yeah.
That's the idea. And that kind of really enhances the movie, actually. It makes it feel a lot like Mad Max Fury Road or something, like in that there's this constant thing going on. You know, it's like a roller coaster, which is how I think movies should be. I think movies should be this sort of thrill ride, which kind
all
of
all movies
you don't want
you
to get
think
off,
should
you know?
Be a thrill ride roller coaster.
Yeah,
not all.
You
but,
should go
but
work
all,
in Hollywood, mate. That's what that's their
well,
whole
like,
bang at
a,
the moment.
A pure movie, like
where
the,
does
I
that
think
leave
it,
movies like Schindler's List? If like you're changing,
you well, imagine I, the critics I, came out and Schindler's List, a roller coaster ride of a movie,
non-stop wall-to-wall action, shot in one shot.
I think it's well, I just feel very strongly that it suits the medium well. I mean, you could do other stuff too, but I just think it's great, really, really good. It feels like a thing that feels like a pet project almost for someone. Like, oh, it's going to be quite hard work for us to shoot it in one shot, but almost like a gimmick, though it could easily become like a gimmick.
Well,
actually,
did you see Children of Men? Have you seen that?
Yeah, well, a long time ago.
So that's a great movie, and it has a few sequences in it that are shot as if it's a single shot, because like it is. They had to use very clever camera work. One of the things they had, there's a scene where they're in a car in the woods and they're attacked from all sides. And the camera has to be able to come in and out of the car and pan around the outside of it, still looking in. And it's that, like, if you look at the behind the scenes, they built this massive framework to go on the outside of the car with all the jib equipment on and everything, and then it's all green screened out and digitally removed. But it's incredible. I must say, it must be terrifying as an actor to think, oh God, please don't let me just fucking sneeze or like trip over or fart or something and ruin this entire shot. And the rehearsals, the practice, everything has to be just right when there are special effects involved. Because later in that same movie, there's a big extended single shot battle scene where there's like 100 plus people involved and special effects going off, and it's insane. It's amazing. But I wonder if, like you said, it almost takes you out of the film because you're marveling at this technological thing, or if you just almost don't notice and you're swept along by it. because it feels so much more urgent and like you're really there. I don't know which it is.
I think you're right. Like there is this danger that stuff will pull you out of the movie. Like seeing, like sometimes a famous actor can do that, like who you don't expect to be
there.
Well,
like we spoke about this on a previous podcast.
Did we?
About unexpected cameos taking you out of the moment.
Yeah, because there was Benedict Cumberbatch is there as like an army officer and he suddenly like turns around and I'm like, oh, fuck me.
It's Benedict.
Not Benedict again.
Yeah.
Sick of this
actually,
guy.
Actually, honestly, really, thought it was a great movie. I would recommend it.
Right.
Yeah, it's been out for a while now, so I went to the cinema with Alex and it was literally just me and Alex.
Oh, that's perfect, because I want to go see it. I might see it this weekend. I'll just go by myself and go see it. And because I like going to the cinema like middle
There's
of the day.
There's something very luxurious
no
about being the only one in the cinema. Yeah. I don't know.
There are a few films I've seen that way and it always feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like having your own personal cinema. I feel like Steven Spielberg going out to like my backyard and just, you know, watching it in my own fucking private
that
cinema.
That movie that we saw, The Shining Part 2, was like that. Remember? There's like one dude in the theater.
Oh, you're right.
We
What's
went
that
like
called?
In the middle of the day. Dr. Feelgood or whatever.
That was fine.
Sleep, yeah, that's fine.
You know what? I saw the film The Perfect Storm in the Trocadero Center and I was alone.
Was that the one with Marky Mark in it?
It had Marky Mark in it and it had George Clooney in it. And I
think
it had
right,
John C. Reilly in it.
Oh,
and they're
right.
fishermen and they're stuck out at sea
that's
in this
right,
horrible
right.
perfect storm, which is a true story. It's a true story, although the film fabricates.
I used to work at Blockbuster Video when that came out on video. I remember we had like a wall of that stupid fucking it was like a DVD at the time
right.
when it came out.
Oh right.
Hey, so
you weren't rewinding.
Right, so
them.
You worked at Blockbuster. I'm very curious.
Yeah.
Did you ever get in a shitload of copies of something and no fucker wanted to see?
Yeah. It? Yeah. There was a whole bunch of movies like that where I can't think of like specific ones, but it did happen for sure.
So you Blockbuster's like
you'd get
this
like a
is
wall of
big.
Them. Yeah. And yeah. And it'd be like they thought like they were anticipating that you know these. Copies of these would just be fucking rented out constantly or whatever, and it was just like it wasn't like that.
So were there films that people that you guys had like just one or two copies of that always seemed to be out and people were always asking about?
Well, yeah, like a certain movie would come out and if we didn't have enough of them then yeah.
Have you got Debbie Does Dallas?
Yeah, there was, but like a big movie, if a big movie came out and we had tons of copies of it and a lot of them didn't rent out, the week after that, half of them would be on sale, like as previously viewed. Like it would like cut down right. like the rental wall sort of thing and then put them on sale.
Because I remember like rental VHSs, you used to have to, if you were a rental shop, you had to buy a rental VHS and it was like £100 or something like that. And so it was quite an expensive like thing. I guess it stopped the shops from like just selling them, you know, because stuff that was rental was before it was available to buy.
That's
or before
right.
It was able to like be on TV. So they were more expensive and you could only get them copies of them like that. And so they were kind of always a bit more valuable, but often you'd get these tapes like X rental. You'd be able to buy them.
Yeah.
After a while.
I started working at Blockbuster,
they were still expensive, but shit quality.
Yeah.
By
yeah
that
really
point.
Bad.
You know
it mean? Was still, like, tons of VHS. Like when I started working at Blockbuster, maybe a year after I worked there, that's when DVDs started like getting bigger and got to the point where we were just getting DVDs in instead of VHS. But that didn't last for very long because it fucking went bankrupt and closed down like a couple of years later. But
because at that point, that's when Netflix started. Because Netflix started as a mailing DVD service where you subscribed and they would post you DVDs to watch. And when you'd finished, you sent them back. And only once you'd sent them back would they send the next lot out. So you made a wish list of films like, here are the 20 films I want to see. And they would send you some that they had. And so it was like, it was cool because you got this poster. You're like, oh, what is it? Yes. And you'd got that film you wanted to see. You'd watch it and you'd quickly send it back to get the next thing on your list. It was great. Like it was really.
Do you remember?
It was so
hype. Remember like, did you ever have like Columbia House and all that kind of stuff? You know, where you'd buy like, you could get like 12 CDs or tapes for free, but then you were in a year contract where you had to buy one like every month, you had to buy one every month.
No, I know. I
think the novelty wears off quick, but I think the psychology of that is actually really powerful. That the whole going to some physical place and putting your tape in the mailbox and then getting another one through the door and opening it up, like that whole process is so much, I don't know, different to the Netflix where we have everything available to us all the time, but we don't want to watch any of it and none of it's exciting. You know, isn't it bizarre?
Yeah,
like
you
that,
just become spoiled for choice. It's kind of like I don't know if you guys like remember those. They were like illegal game cartridges you could get for like Nintendo, and I think they had them for Super Nintendo as well, where you'd like plug it in, you put it in, but it would have like, I don't know, like 100 games on it or whatever. But they weren't translated or anything. They were just like all Japanese or whatever. But I remember like borrowing one off my friend, thinking, oh man, like 100 games, I can't believe it. And then I would play like maybe 5 of them for like 2 seconds and then just move on. Like, cause you just become so spoiled for choice that you just don't even care anymore. It's just like,
it's not
even exciting. Like you said, you're just like, yeah, whatever. 100 games.
But also if they're all crap, you're like, ugh.
I'm like that with my Steam library now. I got all these games. I don't want to fucking play any of them. It's just like, I've got like 600 games in my Steam library and I could care less. Like half of them I haven't even played.
Honestly, like for me, it's been about like looking at top lists, like top 10 lists of movies, top 10 lists of like, top 10 lists of games, but also like some other like top 10 lists of like books and things like this. And I've been sort of working my way down these lists and I've actually found a lot of joy out of that, like just sort of ticking off like, okay, there's these top 5 sci-fi books that I've never read, you know, and I've been going through them. And some of them are fucking super out of date. But Bodega's still available, second edition.
Nice.
Big inspired. And actually reading these sort of, it makes me realize how you obviously have read some of these
classic
sci-fi novels.
How much you ripped off
novels.
To use in your own book.
Gives me a context. It's good. This very retro thing, VHS, is that I remember, one thing I remember is that they would sometimes get a little bit, you know, glitchy and blurry and sort of, you know, like that classic thing when a bit's coming up where there's either a bit of nudity.
You get like audio warping and stuff like that, yeah.
Where people have clearly paused it for a while.
What about Please Be Kind, Rewind, the stickers?
Yeah.
You had to, cause like, that was a thing when you had to return, when it was time to return your VHS tape back to the video store. You had to rewind it, like, or you were considered. I think some places actually fined you if you didn't rewind the tape.
They would open the box to see if the tape was in there.
Because man, there's nothing more annoying than getting home and wanting to watch Debbie Does Dallas, opening the case and realizing that, hang on, this fucking asshole didn't rewind it.
Because it took a long fucking time. Like,
Hell yeah, it did.
This is no joke, man.
Yeah,
we wasted a lot
rewinding.
Of time.
Oh my god,
just rewinding, waiting for shit to rewind. Like, to save batteries on my Walkman, I used to put a pencil through the hole of the tape and spin it.
Yeah.
That's what you used to do. If you put a pencil through the hole and span it
that
around.
That would have taken you ages.
Well, sometimes you had to
save
do that
battery,
if your car stereos were the worst for eating tapes, right? But some Walkmans were really bad, too, especially if they started running out of batteries. They grind slower and then they'd start eating up your tape.
Oh my god. Do you know what that sounds like? Such a trendy man thing to do, right? Like you can see a guy with his Walkman like getting the tape out and then getting a pencil out and just walking along the street like rewinding it slowly. Yeah. Like that's such a it's that physical, again, it's that physical like action of it's like the part of the reason why Tom and Barry like still smoke, right? And I'm like, why do you smoke? You know, come on, it's 2020, like no one is smoking now, like vape or something, I don't know, like get with the times. And they're like, well, they don't smoke that much, but they also like the physical action of actually rolling a cigarette. They find it quite like soothing and calming and like the physical thing.
It's nice.
Part of the reason that people like playing cards for real or rolling dice for real, whereas when you do it on digitally, it doesn't feel, you know, you're detached from that physical interaction, and that physical interaction is such a big part of like that experience. And it's why board games in person are so much more better than digital, you know, because I don't know, like it's hard for a game to even replicate that action of rolling a dice and the satisfaction.
Yeah. Although I note that Tabletop Simulator has the one thing I really like to do when a board game is clearly over, and you can flip the table in Tabletop Simulator.
Oh, yeah. No, that is absolutely great.
That
is the opposite. That's like an enhancement.
It is.
I mean, that's something you can, that's the wish fulfillment. That's why at truck stops or like petrol stations or like these places, they have these like GTA-based trucking games. So a trucker can just drive like a madman, drive off the road and then realize.
Get
it out of their system, you know, because sometimes I think when you're I assume, I don't know, I've never had to do a long haul trucking, but sometimes I think when you're driving along a straight road for 12 hours or whatever in America, you're just going to want to be like, oh, fuck it, what would happen if I just drove off the road right now?
I don't know if anyone would ever do that, honestly, but
no, I don't think people would do, but I think they get that stupid little idea in their head of what would it be like, you know,
sure,
and what would happen,
probably shitty. I'd guess, I think you could
It'd be
really
catastrophic.
But then really bad.
But it might just pop into the head like, I could just turn this wheel. Like the idea of the crazy trucker who's got white line fever, and, you know, his eyes are bloodshot and he's hopped up on amphetamines or meth or whatever the hell he's taking. He's like, I could just turn this wheel when he sees a car coming the other way. But they don't.
It always reminds me of that. I can't remember that quote. Someone famous and much smarter than me. And I remember the quote, but it was that sort of, you know, mankind advances.
It might have been me who said that quote.
Safe outlets for their animal urges. You know, so you know, like violent video games are, you know, a way to like satisfy.
Yeah, that's why nowadays the world is such a chill place.
Well, comparatively, it is, though, really. It provides, like, you know, a way to get your frustrations out. You know, people are raging at Dark Souls and not raging at their mum, or I don't know.
They still are, though. Not everybody plays.
Like, I don't know.
A very small portion of society plays Dark Souls.
So. I think I'm positive generally about video games and the idea of this stuff and about like these types of things.
I think it's a good hobby.
I'm generally positive about the world. I think the internet is this scary thing. By the way, just before we go off this topic, I noticed that there was like an uptick, apparently. I saw a news article that because of the coronavirus and all this like pandemic stuff, people have been watching World War Z and Contagion and all these zombie movies. Like I love the idea that people are like, oh, the coronavirus, isn't that exciting? Let's watch some zombie movies.
Oh, you know what? I wonder if it's necessarily, I don't know if it's necessarily that they're watching them or maybe Netflix is promoting them. Because they're thinking, this is what people want to see. They're all scared of viruses. We'll get some more plays out of these.
No, but I love it. I do you know what? Like, part of... I mean, I'm terrified about, you know, this stuff as much as anyone is. And it's very serious. And you should be careful. Blah, blah, blah. But I do think it's, like, a little bit of a tingle of, like, excitement that, like, people are, you know, the zombie virus is out there, you know? I can see why people are...
Man, there's a fucking billion viruses out there. Like, I mean...
Oh, you're right. It's absolutely.
It's not scary, is it? Like a couple of hundred people have died, yeah. But you got to remember too that like this originated in a place with like terrible fucking hygiene, terrible fucking standards to do with like the preparation of animals for consumption and everything. And it's like I don't know what fucking people expect. Like of course shit like this is gonna get out and spread and stuff. Like if people are just being fucking not good about staying clean and hygienic.
Yeah, if people are eating
a fucking rat's ass, well, yeah, you're probably gonna get sick. You know, like realistically,
it's not even like eating a rat's ass. It's like having like on the counter of a convenience store, you know, as like a little impulse buy, a whole tray full of like deer heads or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like fucking what? Or like are like deer livers? It's like weird fucking shit. Like, oh yeah, just pick up a snack pack of 15 deer livers.
And
like,
I get that once it's contracted, it can spread and everything. And they gotta be careful. Like, I mean, like a couple of hundred people dying is pretty bad, but I mean,
I don't want to seem culturally insensitive over this either, by the way, but there's a bubble tea shop that I go to like just up the road, and it's like a Chinese run place, really nice place.
Jeez,
really,
that is
really
already
smooth.
They've got this big
fridge, and well, half the like the menu's in Chinese, so it obviously caters to like the Chinese students and like the local sort of Asian population. It's great, right? But they've got this massive sort of huge fridge, and in it is just, you look at it and you're like, oh my God. And it's like, it's full of beef tongue and, you know, pig kidney, like just full of the most disgusting sounding meats.
I don't think that
you could think.
And honestly, I don't think that in itself is at all a problem. As long as it's prepared like in a clean environment and stuff. I think what's happening is that in a lot of places, like there's just a lot of complacency. You know, people probably aren't washing their hands as much as they should. People probably aren't like taking enough care with preparing some of this stuff. And then it's just inevitable that shit like this is going to get out and spread around.
No, you're
and stuff
right.
Like that.
But I think it's more likely to happen if people are, if it's in the culture to eat sort of cheap meats.
Yeah.
But not, as a, speaking as someone who's, you know, now like bit of a, arsehole about that stuff. Maybe I shouldn't be criticizing.
I think it's a worry if you're from that place, for sure.
I don't think people should be eating rat asses though, or bat. No, like, biting their heads off bats.
I don't think people should be freaking out about this stuff either, like they seem to. You know, like
even no, you're right. That's the other thing. I think media has built this coronavirus up to be this vast threat.
Yeah,
and I think people should take it seriously as well, but. At the same time, I think
it was kind of the same thing with like bird flu and SARS. Remember SARS and everything? And it's like,
but you can't treat it seriously enough. Really, you should. People are gross. They're sneezing and fucking.
Yeah, of course.
Honestly, everyone needs a fucking bit of advice on not to sneeze on their hand and then kiss someone with it or whatever. I don't know. Fuck whatever you're doing.
Well, this is why when I use public transport. I try not to touch any of the poles.
Right. Or that's a bit racist. Jeez, you should be touching them anyway. Like
the poles.
They're hardworking.
that there's a dad joke for you. There's one.
That is.
Gotcha.
Jesus.
Gotcha.
So no, I just like the idea that do you reckon that stuff happens for other sort of things that people, I don't know, when it's...
Yeah, of course it does.
I don't know, when there's like a big... murder spree going on. People are watching a murder mystery.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Of course it is. It's all.
Do people feed that kind of I mean, it's like part of our culture, right? Like that. Does it enhance the movie knowing that there's like a zombie apocalypse going on?
We're obsessed.
You know, or you could like
imagine
it in your head.
Like, go to any bookstore and look at like the categories for books and stuff. The true crime section is massive, and people have an appetite. To read all of that stuff.
They want to hear all the horrible shit.
They're fascinated by it.
They really
do. So, yeah, every time something happens, like if there's a big earthquake or like the tsunami or whatever, I'm sure that disaster movies saw a huge uptick. Like it's just human nature, right? Like, I don't know. We have these imaginations that need to be
fed. Do you get excited by it as well in a kind of, do you feel guilty about being excited by it? Do you see what I mean?
About what? About disasters?
About like, I don't know, about, do you feel guilty
virus
about being
outbreaks?
Excited that there's a zombie virus going on? You know, if a zombie outbreak did happen.
I'm not excited about that though. Like, so no, I don't feel guilty about it because I don't, it's not something that interests me in the slightest. Like it hasn't prompted me to go and like,
I think some people are like eating their popcorn, like following it really closely and passionately. And I don't know whether they should feel bad about that or not. I don't think they should. I think that it's just a part of it's part of who we are.
I'm old fashioned. Like the new series of Curb Your Enthusiasm started, so I just been watching that.
Oh, I can't wait!
Yeah, there's two episodes out already. It's good.
I can't wait.
Interesting. I'll have to watch that.
Yeah, it's very themed around
cancel
culture this season. So
yeah.
Oh, yeah. is he a little bit politically incorrect, kind of in modern terms? Like, is he? Because some people are kind of quite unapologetically.
I don't think he's. I think it's typical Larry David in that it is massively exaggerated.
He uses things like I know one of the things he does is if he doesn't want to talk to someone, he wants to piss people off, he puts on a MAGA hat. Right now, obviously, in California, that's like a, oh my God, you know, it's like that's
yeah,
really.
Yeah. He avoids like a lunch date with a guy he doesn't want to have a lunch date with. Another really funny thing this season is that he has like an altercation with this guy called Mocha Joe, who runs a coffee shop. And he decides that he doesn't like the way that Mocha Joe operates. He's got wobbly tables and his coffee is cold and all this stuff. So he leases the place next to Mocha Joe's. He's going to open up his own Spike coffee shop to put Mocha Joe under. Fuck me,
oh,
man.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's
that
very
is
funny.
Such like a sweet, sweet revenge thing
funny.
That like you dream about being able to do that stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like if you were opened Just Chips, a competitor to Just Chips called Not Only Chips, or Not Just Chips, and that you sell chips and one other thing.
Yeah.
Nuggets. Yeah.
The thing with Larry David is like, and like the formula of the show is that no matter what he does, he seldom gets away with anything, right?
Yes, like, he never wins.
Yeah, that's something
important.
Always comes back to bite him in the ass. And sometimes those are very intricately drawn out or whatever, and sometimes they're like immediate, but it's just the charm of the show, right? It just makes
but
it so
I also like
funny.
Sometimes he does get a win,
yeah, and when he does it feels great, right? Like it's very funny.
But there's like I mean, one of my favorite episodes, the end to the episode is one of the funniest things. He's in this toilet, like them in the men's room, and he's hidden something down the front of his trousers, And this child comes in and he talks to her and he gives her a hug and she feels the hard thing in the front of his trousers, which is like a pen or a torch or something. And she looks down and runs out and she says to her parents, Larry David hugged me in the bathroom. He's got something hard in his trousers. And all you can hear is the entire room of adults going, what oh, my God! And he just jumps out the bathroom window. And that's the end of the episode. And I mean, he's not commenting. Well, he's not making some clever social
comment.
But that
kind of thing is like your worst nightmare.
Yeah, he's just thinking, what would
it?
Be
like,
the
it's
worst
like,
thing
what
that
is
can
the
happen?
Most awkward nightmare yeah. that could possibly happen to me?
Yeah, and there's no way to explain it. Nobody's going to believe him because, you know, nobody ever
believes
him.
There's no way out.
Exactly.
You run into these things in real life, like, occasionally, and you're like, oh, and sometimes they're close to happening. And you're like, oh, fuck. Can you imagine if this happened? Like, right. Yeah, and that's what Curb is really about, yeah. isn't it? And it's
well, they say
setting
it,
up those.
It's that exaggeration and like this almost like the worst possible scenario thing. Like,
yeah,
the way that he's,
but it's still realistic though. You could still almost see it could happen.
Yeah, the way that he's commenting on like sort of like cancel culture and stuff is that, you know, his manager Jeff Green has lost like a bit of weight and he's like a little bit more like not so clean shaven, so he looks like Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
And a couple of times in the show women are like, oh my fucking God, why is that fucking monster here? And he's like, what the fuck, it's Jeff. Like, it's so fucking funny.
So the funny thing is my mum had watched a few episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm and thought that was Harvey Weinstein.
It looks
not,
just
oh
like
my
him.
God.
Certain,
because he really does look
ways,
like
yeah,
him.
It looks like him. Same build, same sort of like big face and everything. Yeah, like it's
I just thought it was so funny because she was like, he's in that Curb Your Enthusiasm show. I was like, no, mum, no, they're two completely different people.
So there's like, so there's that prop element to it that sort of like solidifies like his wrongdoings. You know what I mean? It's like every time anybody accuses him of something, he's like, no, come on, it was innocent. And then they see him with Jeff, and then they're like, oh, fuck, no, it wasn't. Like, you're an asshole. You hang out with Harvey Weinstein. But, like, it's just funny stuff, right? Like, he goes on a date with this woman, and, like, he gets his phone and records his advances. So he's like very, very like
oh
procedurally
God,
asking
great.
Her if it's okay for him to put his hand on her shoulder and then can he like kiss her and stuff. And she's like agreeing to it. And then he's like, basically like, can I fondle your breasts? And she's like, no. And he's like, all right, it's a no. And I'm fine with that. It's like all captured on tape. It's fucking so funny. It's awkward as hell to watch too. But I mean, that's
it
part
is.
Of the charm of the
but
show.
But I don't find it as cringy as I thought I would. Like, I still
no.
find
no,
it. I don't know why it
is.
It's
it?
Because he's such an unlikable character. But at the same time, there are times when you were really rooting for him because some of the people he comes across are so fucking unreasonable and obnoxious. Like, yeah. Everybody is. He is. Half the people he bumps into are. They're all very unpleasant, apart yeah. from, like, a few people. But, yeah, they all jump to conclusions. They're very judgmental. You know, it's like, some of the stuff, he's like, this is perfectly reasonable. And other people see it not that way. Like, I love the episode where there's the soldier. And they all say, thank you for your service. Thank you for your service. And Larry's like, hi, nice to meet you. Like, why couldn't you thank him for his service, Larry? And it's like, becomes a big thing where he feels, I don't have to thank him. You know, he didn't do it for me and all this kind of stuff. It was really
exactly,
funny.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. He's got a finger on the pulse of kind of not, why do I have to be a sheep? Why are people really saying that? Like, and it's the questions that we've all asked in the back of our mind, but we normally just ignore
right.
or don't care.
He's
we're like,
the guy who
I'm
actually
just
say
yeah.
challenges every norm
it?
And just says, no, yeah. I don't want to do that. Why should I? Explain it to me.
And I
they'll just
respect that.
Yeah, and most people's yeah. response is, you just have to. He's like, well, no,
a bit
I don't.
Like you and your personal
but
trainer,
that's,
Lewis.
That's the essence of stand-up, at least his generation of stand-up. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like the kind of commenting on
yeah,
why
like
we
observational
do things.
Sort of humor.
Yeah,
right?
Like comment, the classic
social,
yeah, observation
social
stuff.
Commentary and stuff. But
I mean, that was where he came from, I guess.
Yeah, it's not highly political though, which is interesting.
All right, so here's a question for you guys about stand-up comedy. So I've watched quite a few episodes of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, the Jerry Seinfeld
oh,
thing.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Which I really like. I'm a big fan of stand-up comedy, and like a lot of the comedians, and he gets writers on and stuff like that, and actors uh-huh. that are all funny. Some of them are not so good. Like, I don't know why he got Seth Rogen on. But,
the only thing that puts me off about that show is that some of those guys just, like, rate themselves way too highly. You know what I mean? I get it. If you're, like, a, you know, Jerry Seinfeld level comedian, like, you right. know, one of the most successful all time or whatever. But I hate when they start like talking shop about it and like sort of saying like, this is how it should be. And like, you're not really a comedian if you're not doing this, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, all right. You know, like,
yeah. So that was my exact point was that one of the conversations that they had was that being a stand-up comedian is the hardest job in the world. That was what they said. Now, that immediately made me think, fuck off. There are much harder jobs.
Yeah.
But
have you seen that?
Consider this. How many really successful?
Yes.
How many really successful stand-up comedians are there? How many?
There's quite a few, but really,
not in the same way. Most of them just turn up, do a few gigs, and they never really make it. There is a very small group of people you would consider successful stand-up comedians that can like really do well. Like, there are a lot more singers and musicians than there are comedians.
A comedian can't hide behind a studio like a musician can, sort of thing, right? Like a musician,
you can't just teach it.
A musician can have support with like a studio band who might be exceptionally good, which could make all the difference, sort of thing. A musician can hide behind studio technology as well, like voice changing, effects, like all that kind of stuff. You can,
they have
like,
a band.
I mean, like they've proven time and time again with like X Factor and Pop Idol and American Idol and stuff like that, that they can just manufacture these people out of nothing and make them successful. But a comedian has to be not only funny, but like personality, likable. They have to be intelligent, like fairly witty and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of like masteries involved. But you couldn't just go
to school and learn how to be funny.
No,
like if you think about it, there are far more doctors. There are definitely more surgeons, brain surgeons in the world than successful comedians. Like you can, if you're smart, you can learn how to be a brain surgeon. Well, you can learn how to be a doctor. I mean, I'm not saying it's not incredible.
I think you can train to be a comedian as well.
I don't think you can. I don't think you can.
But I think you'd only do it if you had some sort of natural base of talent to begin with. Because
I think you have to start very young. Yeah, like a lot of these famous comedians were funny. They're a funny kid at school. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? And they've always like been trying to make people laugh for their whole life. And often, like, I can see where they're coming from, like with the hardest job in the world. Because I think that certain personality types are not going to sit well with the career of doing the same material every night to a crowd who are going to boo you or not laugh at some of your jokes, and crafting that thing and working and trying to make funny jokes. It's tough to be creative and come up with material and do it to a standard that is like enough to make a living off of. And the risk so a little bit like being in any art form, like being in a band or something, or being in something where you have to, or doing arts that you have to then sell. I don't know. It's like, that's not for everyone. It's not a safe career, is it, being a comedian? There's no stuff to fall back on.
But a lot of them, they're like, I had to work for like, I mean, Louis C.K. is a good example. The dude wasn't young when he made it to the big time. He'd had years and years and years as a stand-up comic, working all kinds of shit, and then he suddenly became really popular, and then it all obviously fell apart. But the point is, he wasn't like a young guy when he made it.
No.
Some guys like Eddie Murphy was successful from a very young age.
Yeah, he was.
Like he was one of the youngest successful comedians around and was a huge Hollywood star. But a lot of them, you know, it comes later in life.
He had
when they've honed the skills.
Yeah. And I think I think like in Eddie Murphy's case, and maybe in other comedians' cases as well, is that if they're lucky enough to start from a young age and work clubs where more established people are working, they'll almost take them under their wing and like sort of, you know what I mean? Like with Eddie Murphy,
I mean, there are absolutely skills to learn.
You had like, you know, Richard Pryor like had a lot to do with Eddie Murphy, and Eddie Murphy used to say that he thought that Richard Pryor just didn't like him because it was kind of like a sign that Richard Pryor was like almost done, sort of thing. It's like, oh, here's this new black comedian who is basically going to replace you, Richard. And he was like, oh, okay, cool. But like secretly like, ah, fuck this guy. Like, you know, I'm not ready to like give up my crown sort of thing.
I think it's very hard for people to do that, to come to terms with, you know, decline of their industry, or you know, when you're on top, it's everyone, you know, being the big thing and then not being the big thing, and someone's always going to be climbing and someone's always going to be falling, and it's, I don't know, like people aren't it's not part of our culture or education to learn to deal with this stuff, or even like know where to start.
Yeah.
You know, or people don't even think they have to. And so people have to come to terms with it themselves often, or and some people have like support of their family and stuff and other priorities. You know, like there's good examples in Hollywood of people at the top of their career dropping out to be with their family or something like that, you know, for sometimes 10 or 20 years, or even dropping off the face of Hollywood entirely. And other people just never stop.
Yeah.
You know, even into their like 80s Nicolas and 90s, Cage, they're always doing stuff. Like Christopher Lee or something like this. You know,
he's never going to fucking stop, is he? Jesus.
No, he's not. But I mean, the dude's standards are so low.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you can always find like literally the lowest. He'll do anything.
Well, that was a tax thing though, right, too. He had to like... He got like in trouble and didn't have any money. He went bankrupt. So he had to just do some quick work to get back in, get paid for his mortgage and stuff.
But he'd been doing shit for a very long time. But the weird thing to me is there are some actors that seem to have this really great career ahead of them, and it just, they stop being in stuff.
Yeah.
Like I watched a thing about Ed Norton the other day. Ed Norton, American History X.
Yeah.
He was the Incredible Hulk.
Fight Club.
And it felt like Ed Norton was in a lot of stuff. Ed Norton. And then the last thing I can remember seeing him in was Birdman. He was playing a part in that as an actor who's a complete shithead to work with.
Yeah.
And that's not that far from the truth, because it turns out he's kind of a prick. And a lot of people are like, I'm never fucking working with that guy again, because he's extremely particular about the way he does things. He wants to rewrite scripts and he changes his lines a lot and just says, no, I'm not doing that. It's got to be this way and everything. And that's it. Like, people just won't work with him. I mean, there must be... Brendan Fraser is a classic example of a guy who was in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And everybody knew Brendan Fraser. And then all of a sudden, the dude's not in anything. Like, he's just fucking done. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
And it must be terrifying as an actor, especially if that what kind
did
of
he
actor.
Did he get blacklisted or something?
No, no, he just... He made a couple of really shitty movies.
Yeah, I think he just was in just too much stuff. And yeah, I just don't think he got many more sort of big opportunities after that.
The thing is,
the way it goes.
I think any actor that pitches themselves as the lead, whether it be a leading man or a leading lady in a film, if you can't pull off lead anymore and you're not a box office draw, you're done.
Yeah.
Like, it's a real gamble. Like, if you pitch yourself as, I mean, Brendan Fraser, you know, lead man in quite a few movies. And if he's no longer the lead man, he's no longer a box office draw, but he's still going to want to be quite high up on the billing. He's going to want to be front and center on the poster. You know, he's going to want this. He's going to want that. And studios would be like, well, no, we don't need you. We've got this other guy and people like him. So we're going to cast him. So then you need to be able to step back and say, all right, I'll just be support roles.
Yeah.
But people are going to be like, oh shit, it's Brendan Fraser. Didn't he used to be a leading man? So it's like this whole, like if you see someone who used to, like if Tom Cruise only popped up in cameos now, very occasionally in some weird movie, you think, what the fuck happened to Tom Cruise's career? But instead, Tom Cruise is the guy. Tom Cruise is like at the top of the poster.
Yeah, of course.
His face and is right there because he's
big,
the biggest.
He still gets really big roles and stuff.
Like right. He's positioned as a lead. He could never go back to just being a supporting actor.
I think that's about what. Again, it's about where they've been, right? If they're going from something big to something small, you know, you could, sometimes that's even like, you know, framed as just a passion project or like, oh, this famous guy is doing something he really wants to do. You know, even if it's like a small independent movie or something weird, you just think, that's just something that he's interested in, sure.
Or they talked him into it or something, or he knows the guy.
But, you know, sometimes we assume it's like, oh, well, God, look at what Nick Cage is being forced to do.
I think the only way back, and this is true, this is especially true for women, is that if you've been like either the lead woman in the film, like as the normally in Hollywood, it'll be like the love interest or whatever, you then have this 20 or 30 year gap where you're no longer considered like, I mean, do you remember, what's her fucking name? Rene Russo.
Rene Russo.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. So she was in one of the Lethal Weapon movies.
Yeah.
She was in a bunch of films as like the hot woman who's like the love interest. And then she's just kind of not in stuff for a while because she's not old enough to play the older maternal wise woman, but she's not young enough to be love interest.
Yeah,
anymore.
That's a thing. A thing with women, right? It's harder for women, I think, in Hollywood because of the types of roles that they play and stuff, you know, like they.
Yeah, you do hear this a lot.
They're either young and like hot and all the magazines want to do like bits on them and blah, 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 blah. Or they're like Judy Dench, you know what I mean? Like,
right, exactly.
But there's no in between. There's no roles in between that where they can like really sort of you know, make a gigantic like mark for themselves.
Not once they've gone down that route of being the eye candy.
Yeah.
Because if you look at someone like Meryl Streep, say, Meryl Streep's career has been pretty fucking good the whole way.
Yeah.
Because she's an actor first and foremost. There may be romance in the film, but it's not like she's on there because people are going to go, oh, fuck yeah, Meryl Streep. I want to go see her tits. She's Meryl Streep. You know what I mean? You're admiring her because she's a great actor.
Yeah.
And she picks the right parts. I mean, Megan Fox or whatever, she can't act for shit. I just want to see her tits.
This is it. Like, honestly, you see it. Like, James Bond gets older every, you know, the same James Bond or Daniel Craig gets older every episode, but his girlfriends or love interest in the movie stay the same. Leonardo DiCaprio is, I mean, the movie version of it. You know, he's like 55 right. now, but he won't date a woman over like 25, you know, because he's just like constantly recycling new ones.
Yeah, Ricky Gervais made a joke about him about the Golden Globes being like too long.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, this it's like 3 hours long, and by the time it's over, Leonardo DiCaprio's girlfriend will be too old for him or something like that. It's like, pretty funny.
That kind of stuff is really true. Like, you know, you see it in Hollywood remakes where they get the same actors back. But obviously, but in many cases, it's like, you know, I don't know, Harrison Ford coming back. But, you know, his love interest of the original movie is now like 60 years old. And it's like, well, we can't have him kissing her. We got to find someone, you know, a bit younger. It's not like, for example, Daniel Craig's not kissing, you know, Judi Dench, is he? I reckon they should like fucking,
that would be great.
I reckon they should do that though. I reckon they should just turn it on its head.
I don't think they should do that. I wouldn't watch that.
Let's just have some realistic relationships in these things.
I don't really want to watch Daniel Craig kissing somebody young either though. Like, I just don't really want to watch Daniel Craig, full stop. Like, I don't care
but
what he's doing.
The problem is Hollywood has this sort of responsibility to set the tone, right? And often, like, it doesn't do a good job on this thing. If it normalizes kind of old guys kissing young women, that's how we get Donald Trump being normalized kind of thing with his, like, you know, young wife kind of thing. Like, it's kind of a bit... People are just cool with it because of Hollywood being so legitimizing it. I don't know. Hollywood has this... role as a trendsetter and a ground level cultural influencer, where it's like, this is what our society is like. And a lot of things, like, I've been watching a couple of YouTube channels about this, because one of them popped up on Reddit last week about like the double standards of like male sexual assault in movies. You know, if like a school kid is like with the South Park, and lots of people have talked about it before, but like if a school kid is like, you know, a schoolboy and a teacher are getting it on, the schoolboy is like, oh, well done, high five, you know, whereas like if it's a schoolgirl or teacher, it's like completely, you know, demonized and terrible. You know, there's this double standard there, and Hollywood kind of has helped perpetrate that to some extent. We don't necessarily see men being taken advantage of by women. You know, it's almost like the men always want it, or, you know, that somehow it's good and they're like, oh, you should be happy to get this, you know. And obviously in many cases, you know, it's not a good thing. You know, it's not cool. And then people were not, you know, if you're not kind of consenting to this stuff, you know, it can be very dangerous. But Hollywood has had like a history of making, you know, it's certainly prison rape is a good example as well. Like it's like so prevalent in Hollywood that part of it is that, you know, don't go to prison or else you'll get raped by a man. It's like, whoa, okay. I never want to go to prison because I don't want to get raped by a man. But it's almost understood that that's like a ground level. Like if you're going to go to prison, you're going to get raped by a man. And so maybe in prison, the prison officers are like, yeah, do you know what? There's a bit of man raping going on. It's all kind of cool. We allow it. Like because of Hollywood, like, I don't know. It's do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the whole
I don't
undertone.
I kind of follow your point.
Yeah, no, I don't.
But like but the video is like even like dropping the soap and stuff has become this thing, which is even in kids' movies. Like there's like Toy Story and like SpongeBob are making jokes.
Wait, there's a
dropping the
soap. There's a drop the soap joke in Toy Story?
Yeah, they're everywhere. They're like absolutely so prevalent. Like
yeah, but
they're in all
that's because in kids' TV and kids cinema and stuff, the good studios make movies that not only appeal
that
to children
jokes
but
in.
They have very subtle adult humor in them as well.
Yeah,
so that,
yeah.
That's true, but I just find it weird that that's in there.
It is, but a kid would never be able to know what it is.
That's true.
You know, until they're old that's, enough
but
to,
I will say this about the whole drop the soap thing is the idea that just dropping the soap, like, that's it. like you drop the soap, you bend over and pick it up, pow, that's it. They're raping you. Like,
well, as if exactly.
They have to wait for you to drop the soap before they're like, well, if he drops that soap, I'm going in. Otherwise, yeah. You know, it would be
wait,
too difficult.
Wait, Larry, back off. He dropped a comb. That's not soap.
It's a comb. It's not soap. It's not soap.
It is a Larry David thing, which makes you just pause for a second and be like, was that a prison rape joke like that I just watched? Like, is that actually cool? Is that actually still... Should I be laughing? You know, I mean, it's a little bit of like you're a sheep, though. You're just laughing along. You're just, you know, saying to the soldier, thank you for your service again. You know, is it something which we should be kind of more aware of?
It's
now?
It's like an in-joke sort of thing, right? Like, because you grew up in a time where like that joke was made or it was popularized. And 20 years later, the joke is made again in some new way or some subtle way or whatever, you're like, oh yeah, that's familiar to me, haha, I'm laughing, sort of thing. It doesn't actually make it funny, but it's just what it is, right? Like, what are these people saying, that we shouldn't laugh at that, or like we should feel bad for laughing at that, or
I think you should just be more sensitive to what you're joking about. Like, I think that if you continue to perpetrate a stereotype that is, you know, that if you go to prison as a man, you're going to be raped. It's a dangerous thing because it has this massive, broad effect on society, that you are trivializing male, you know, abuse, and you are laughing at men who are more feminine or more, you know, for being inferior.
Oh, did you get recommended the same video I did that pointed out that there are an awful lot of instances in Hollywood movies where women sexually assault men, and it's seen as like a kind of a jokey thing?
Yes, that's the one I'm talking
about.
So
I watched that, and there was a scene in there. I think it was Mindy. Is her name Mindy Kaling? She was in The Office. She was Kelly in The Office, the annoying secretary.
She's the writer as well, I think.
Yeah, she's one of the writers for sure. So there's a scene. I think James Franco is passed out, and she kisses him while he's passed out, and he wakes up. He's like, "Oh, help!" And she's like, "Sure, shut up. It didn't happen." All this kind of stuff. And the interesting thing is, if those roles were reversed, we would be like, this is entirely inappropriate. I mean, if the male hero of a movie was sexually assaulting the female lead in the movie, it would be seen as like, holy shit, what the fuck? How did this get made? But it does happen a lot. There is a scene in Horrible Bosses where Jennifer Aniston rapes one of her employees, and it's played for laughs, like it's a comedy. So it is weird, like you said, how it's seen as something to joke about. And I just think a lot of the time, these movies are not written by younger people. They're written by older people. And you see the same jokes popping up and the same references popping up. And it's just, I mean, I'll give you an example. I was watching The Simpsons with my kids. And if you look at the first few series of that, that was made in the 90s, bear that in mind, like mid-90s these episodes were coming out. There were references to like things that happened 20, 30 years
ago.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah, like the...
Yeah, but I'm thinking these writers are older guys.
Yeah, they are.
Who is getting these references? Like, these aren't written really for the audience. They're like... So I think the same thing happens in Hollywood. By the time you get established, by the time you're like the lead writer on a big movie and everything, or a big TV show or whatever, you're older.
Again,
so your references are going to be older, and your attitudes are going to be older.
The Simpsons was designed for primetime TV, and I remember when it came out, it was everybody wanted to watch it, like kids, kids especially, but it had lots of adult humor in it that kids just didn't understand, the references or whatever, but they still loved it. Like, it's one of those... It's that formula, right? Pixar does it really well. Like, lots of studios do it really well, where they can appeal massively to children and make this thing that children just want to have, or, you know, call their own or whatever. But it just has lots and lots of adult humor in it as well, that's subtle enough for kids to not pick up on it, but it makes it entirely not tedious for you to have to sit through 2 hours of it with your kids, sort of thing, you know what I mean? Simpsons is no different.
Yeah, it's very clever.
It was on, you know, it was on early, like it was usually on at like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. So like, if you were 10, 11 years old, you were staying up to watch it, like easy.
Oh,
yeah. And like, and you did.
I mean, we didn't have cable, so I couldn't
watch it. It was the popular thing. You didn't go to school the next day having not watched it, or else, you know what I mean? Like,
and I mean, I think it's hard. Like, you look back 20, 30 years at these things, and they are a product of their time, and they're a product of the people who wrote them, and we're a product. We're not that smart. We're a product of our cultural indoctrination, if you like. You know, we've been brought up with things in a way that we find acceptable or not acceptable. And sometimes we have to stop now and say, okay, maybe we shouldn't be making jokes about this. But sometimes you don't even realize.
I don't know if the joke sometimes is about that, though. That's what I like. You, like I can see the comedy in reversing a role.
You're right.
The context of that is sometimes maybe not like amazingly well thought out or whatever. But there is definitely an element of comedy to.
And sometimes the way to bring attention to these role reversals is to satirize it, is to do an extreme example where people were like, oh shit, yeah, like, because in South Park the way they did it was very much like aware. It was like, you know, because I think like Kyle or someone goes to the police and is like, you know, there's like a guy in my class who's like seeing one of the teachers, and they're like, nice. Do you know what I mean? It's very much like, it's very cleverly done. And so, I don't think that we should like cancel comedy that we love because the writer or guy who did it turns out to be an arsehole or have views that we don't agree with. I think there is a lot of that, like a lot, for example,
comedy works best when it's on the very edge sort of thing. Like, you know, we find upsetting things sometimes quite funny. And especially if it's presented in a clever way or like, you know, it's odd, isn't it? Like, I think it's easier to watch comedy when you're not like affected by any of the stuff being discussed, right? And it's probably a lot more difficult when you take it more personally or are affected by the stuff that happens. You know, like I can laugh at a prison rape joke because I've never been raped in prison. I've never been to prison before, so sure. You know, it's not the funniest goddamn thing I've ever heard, but like whatever, like. Like there's a whole segment of Norm MacDonald on that YouTube channel, and the prison rape jokes from Saturday Night Live and like his earlier stuff.
Yeah, his stuff is he does that a lot where he pushes the line, but he does it because he knows he's going to get a response.
But it is funny. His delivery is amazing. It is very funny.
I don't want to devalue like that. Like a good comedian will make you laugh at jokes that and you can still enjoy stuff. Like I think that a good example is like J.K. Rowling and you know, actually, for example, someone tweeted me this week saying you should unfollow Graham Linehan, who wrote like Father Ted and Black Books and stuff. And I think when I signed up to Twitter about 10 years ago, I automatically followed a lot of people who I was a fan
of. Sure, or thought like you were.
Jimmy Carr.
I mean, you don't know these
Bill
people.
Bill Bailey.
He writes a show that you like.
No, because I want to see funny tweets on Twitter from them. You know, I like Father Ted. I want to see his funny tweets, you know. And someone tweeted me and said, you should unfollow him because he's done a load of anti-trans stuff and commentary. And I was like, do you know what? I don't think I will. I'm just going to unfollow him. I don't think it's worth the trouble. I don't think that this guy particularly is obviously like, but it's a little bit in my head though. I'm a little bit like, oh, Father Ted's now a bit tainted. Like Harry Potter's a little bit tainted by.
You know, the thing is, okay, fine. You've unfollowed him. You've unfollowed him off the suggestion of somebody, but you haven't unfollowed him for like the pure reason, right? You've just unfollowed him because
it's tough in my head to rationalize.
Somebody's pressuring me and I don't want to be seen as somebody who agrees with what this guy might have said,
but
even though I haven't looked
into
it.
That's what cancel culture is
exactly
about. I still think the main thing to do is, if first of all, I don't want to know Graham Linehan. I don't care what his opinions are.
I want to see
Father Ted is a funny show. That's
what
I care about.
Something on Twitter that's even remotely funny and related to Father Ted. Great. That's why I followed him in the first place, because of Father Ted. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, also, Twitter is real easy to be as puritanical as you like about whatever it is you believe in. But I guarantee you, even people you know really well, there'll be something, opinion that they hold that you think, what? That's fucking bizarre. Like, I can't get my head around. That's weird. That you what are you going to stop seeing that person because there's something you disagree with them about? I don't know. I mean, I know lots of people whose politics are wildly different from mine, or their opinions about all kinds of stuff are wildly different from mine.
Yeah.
It doesn't change the fact that they're essentially a decent enough person that I can be friends with them. I just think it's not worth analyzing with a microscope every single aspect of a person's personality, because no one is clean. Moment is going to come out of it and you're going to be okay with everything they say.
And I don't think they're evil if they have flaws like that or beliefs necessarily either. I think it's that they're a product of their cultural like teachings, like what they have been informed of over the years via media and Hollywood and books and people and friends and family and surroundings and locales. You know, if you're brought up in a local a small village in India, I'm sure you're going to hold views that are, you know, intolerant towards something. And who knows what that is, or views that are reprehensible in other parts of the world. You know, if you're in China and you're eating deer noses, fucking go for it. Like, you know, that's part of your culture. And I think it's very hard of me to criticize that because, you know, that's something which they are not going to change their view on very easily. And you know, I don't even think about a lot of my biases, you know, until I watch a video on YouTube that tells me maybe you should question this thing. Like, there's so... Being a scientist is about questioning. It's about constantly analyzing everything you believe.
Yeah.
But there's so many aspects of things we believe, from religion to politics to people to... And there's so many, like, gray areas too, so many gray lines that come down. Like, and each case is different. You know, you could say... Oh, you know, that this is good for society because maybe prison rape fucking, you know, discourages people from committing crimes. Maybe the people are so scared of being raped in prison that they won't do crimes. Like, you know, everything has like this other fucking side to it that, you know, you can't. I'm a bit of a contrarian. I love to try and argue and see the opposite side. And it's so hard to do that sometimes. And sometimes I feel like I've been blindsided and I've learned something. I'm like, damn, why have I been laughing at prison rape jokes for like 35 years? I feel like maybe I shouldn't. But then it's tough. It's really, and so what I'm saying is, don't be too hard on yourselves if you find that your beliefs are challenged, you know?
Like, I don't hold a strong belief on that though. Like, you know, if that offends somebody to laugh at that and they're around me or whatever, I would apologize. I would say, oh, sorry.
Yeah. You know, like, it's not worth clinging to that kind of shit.
I'm a reasonable person. I'm not going to fight for my right to laugh at prison rape jokes. I just don't care enough. But equally, I'm not going to falsely support like trans rights and stuff as well by unfollowing somebody on Twitter, because as much as I support somebody's right to be who they are or who they want to be and freedom and stuff like that, these are things that don't really affect me. I'm not going to be as passionate about them as somebody who is affected by it, you know, or living that life or whatever. You know what I mean? I think there's
absolutely.
I think there's a lot of like almost like false support for movements nowadays just to appear sort of like politically correct or popular or something like that. And I don't agree with that either. I you know, I think people that are coming out and being like overly sort of supportive about something that they have nothing to do with or whatever is not a genuine thing. It's lying.
You see that in Hollywood
a lot.
Yeah,
of course
as well,
you do.
Where they'll,
of course
they
you do.
Cast something and it's like the cast is like, you can tell they brainstormed the shit out of how to get the perfect cast to avoid bad reviews on Twitter and in the media.
Sure.
It feels disingenuous.
Yeah,
you know it's not from the heart.
No.
You know they haven't changed. They're just going with the trends.
It is. It's some sort of formula for like popularity or for money or sales or something like that, and it doesn't feel nice. It doesn't feel good. Like
yeah, we should be on top of that stuff too.
I think you should expect somebody to support me with just about anything, really. But like, you know what I mean? Like, it's I think it's important to just be yourself and not get caught up in the hype of everything. You know what I mean? Like, just and don't be an asshole either.
Yeah, that's a better
rule.
There's
this fear that if you, it's a very animal thing. It's that if you change your mind, you're seen as flaky, or if you're seen as like, it's like a good thing to hold a whole ground and be brave and stand your ground and defend your argument to the last.
Yeah.
And sometimes you've dug that hole so much, you're like, fuck, I can't change my mind
now
or else I'm going to look like an arsehole.
Do you wonder if they're clinging on in the hope that they'll eventually be vindicated as, well, he was right, and he said it all along. Like, that's...
I don't know if
you're just hoping,
I think
one day things will swing in your favor.
I think people people seem to value... And that it's that confidence. It's that kind of... That authority of someone who is just blindly confident. For some reason, people value that. And
it is weird.
And people are scared to change their minds or be seen to be changing their minds.
You know what?
And no, but that's the opposite. You should be willing to constantly... bounce back and forth
I feel like this podcast would be way better if I could actually articulate my thoughts like in an intelligent manner and not just like being a dope.
And this is what I said at the very start of the podcast, is that words are not enough. Like we need graphs.
That's
we need pictures.
That's this week's theme, is the song More Than Words
like prepared
by Extreme.
Speeches that are finely honed and crafted to not because, but a lot of the time people will get the wrong end of the stick from this podcast. They're going to think Lewis said this sentence, and people are going to take it out of context, and it'll mean something which is the opposite of what I meant.
Yeah,
it to me.
I know. I think
it's a very complex topic.
I do my best. I think I'm a reasonable person. I don't think I'm overly offensive to any one person or group of people. I don't have hate in my heart for anything other than people who are sweaty at Overwatch and other competitive games. No, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going out of my way to like spread hate or to spread misery or whatever. I think I'm like a pretty easygoing, happy-go-lucky sort of person. And
a live and let live kind of guy.
Yeah, and I think...
Or live and let die.
I think that's enough. I don't feel like I need to do more than that. You know what I mean?
James Bond kissing Judi Dench next... Bond movie. Let's get it.
She's
I
dead.
Don't want it.
Let's
I
get
don't,
she
I don't,
died
let's...
in one of the previous movies, didn't she?
What?
Not my little
let's
Judy.
Bring her back. Fuck it. Bring her back as a Bond girl.
Not my little Judy.
I reckon she could rock
she
it.
Comes out of the scene in a bikini, one of those big onesie old lady bikinis, and James Bond cracking a boner right there on the beach.
Like the 1920s where it's like where she's got one of those dressing screens and stuff.
She's 85, guys. Holy shit.
Oh, man. Can't be it's tough nowadays, isn't it? It's tough. It feels like you have to constantly just say the right things and not say the wrong things or whatever. And I think it's a shame in some ways, you know. I think it's a lot of in some ways a lot of like censoring like unnecessarily too, right?
I do wonder if people are as sensitive as the current culture would imply they are. I think people are tougher. I do think we should definitely work towards not excluding people with language and stuff like that, because it must be pretty shitty to constantly feel less than everybody else because of things that people are saying casually, as just like part of, oh, that's just a thing that happens. And we talk about stuff in movies as informing public opinion and stuff like that. And I think everyday language and everyday attitudes do as well.
Yeah.
But I don't think that we need to be quite as eggshell, you know, sort of treading as we are in regards to people. Most people, that's the other thing to remember. Most people on the planet, or even in whatever country you're in, just don't give a shit about this kind of stuff. They don't have a strong opinion one way or the other.
No.
Most people, I find, have a pretty much live in that they've, oh, that's their business, no problem. You know,
I think, yeah. I think
the
majority
specifics
of people.
Of
yeah.
Going and telling someone, you're not allowed to do this anymore.
A lot of the media that we consume, a lot of the stuff that we read is very... You're meant to believe that it's the vast majority speaking, but it's like anything, right? It's always
I think most people understand.
It's always
a
handful of people.
Things are pretty decent. You know, things are going okay. Change takes time. I think a lot of the time, I consider myself a pretty progressive person. A lot of my personal views, people on my side of things, as it were, want change really fast and now, and everything has to be exactly the way they want it. And public attitudes take time to change. They do change,
sure.
But slowly. And I just think, yes, you know, it's all right to be impatient and look for change, but it doesn't have to happen overnight. As long as you can just gradually introduce ideas that everything is cool and maybe we can be nicer to each other and this is okay and acceptable. But it doesn't have to be like instantly you either do this or you're canceled, because all that does is get pushback. And people think, oh, fuck you. People feel under attack. That's what you want to get rid of. So I've always said for a very long time that I feel like the ideas of the left appeal to people at a base level, but we have the worst salespeople in the world. And we cannot sell our ideas in a way that appeals to people, even though sometimes they're in their exact interests. But we sell it
this is it.
You've got to do this, and almost like, how dare you, and you're wrong. And it's like, well, the right doesn't really do that. The right just says, hey, even they make all these promises, they lie. And I'm not obviously not saying everyone on the right is a liar and everything, but a lot of the current right-wing politics that you see and anti-progressive agendas and stuff, they make very easy promises, which are, we're with you, and we're not going to tell you to change, and these people are wrong.
I'm going to turn up to work most days.
It's much easier to believe that you were already right, that you were right all along, that you don't need to change, that this is some crazy shit, rather than saying, hey, maybe we were wrong about this and we need to change. For the exact reason you said, is people don't want to backpedal. They don't want to appear that they were wrong all along. It's very brave to come out and do that, even though it shouldn't be brave. I change my mind about stuff all the time based on new evidence.
This is why scientists don't run the country, because they appear as wishy-washy. They appear as, you know,
everybody says, you should think the Earth was flat, scientists, and now they think it's round. Well, they make up your mind. It's like, that's the whole point, is that we changed. We figured it out, you know, and society should change in the same way. But instead it's seen as, oh, they can't say anything these days. And you just think, well, you can. You can say an awful lot of things these days. We're just asking gradually, and I would hope gently, some of these things are not cool to say. But instead everybody pushes back, everybody's arguing and screaming at each other, everybody wants everything to change overnight to their exact specifications, and you end up with a shit show.
Much like this podcast. Anyway, see you later. Just joking. That was a good one. Man, we ranted a lot today. It was very ranty.
It was.
That was a ranty, thoughtful
episode. Had a lot to get off our chests, I feel, you know?
I've been thinking about this stuff, and it's nice to talk to you guys about it.
Every once in a while, you have to have a big blowout, don't you?
Just bear in mind that this was just a conversation between three people. I'm sure if we listened
three
on...
Idiots who've watched a YouTube video.
But if we listened on all of your conversations, I bet you say some dumb shit too. This is just an unedited splurge of thoughts and ideas and conversation, and just take it as that. Don't think of it as some kind of manifesto.
Yeah. Change the world.
Vote for me.
Raise up.
Bye.
See you
guys. 2020.
See you guys next week. Love you lots. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye. Bye.